Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I am here with Frank. Frank, how are you?
Hey, Nick. I am doing great. Really happy to be joining you on the podcast here.
Thank you so much for making some time for us. Before we jump in, why don't you just tell us your name, a little bit about yourself, and any disclaimers Sure. you might want to share for the legal folks listening so that they know that this is a totally legally compliant podcast here.
Absolutely. So I am Frank Gallia. I'm based here in San Francisco. I've got about 20 years of financial services experience. Started off on the IT side and then moved over to compliance. And today I'm speaking just as an individual, not as a representative of my firm. So just to be really clear, I'm going to talk to Nick about my personal experiences. Is a mid-level person in a compliance career, and give a sense for where the profession has evolved in the last 20 years and some of the directions that we're seeing compliance moving towards in the future.
I love it. So we met on LinkedIn and we started talking, and Frank had a lot of cool things to say on this intersection of IT and compliance. And he has a background as a CFA charter holder. See, I used that properly, Frank. He's a CFA charter holder. And we just thought it would be great to get on here and, you know, kind of jump in and start talking about some of this stuff. So Frank, why don't we start by just kind of telling us a little bit about your story, how you got into this game, how you got, sure. you know, from the IT piece into compliance, and what some of those changes you've seen over the last, you know, couple of decades have been?
Yeah, so around 2001 to 2003, I was working at a big financial services company in the IT department for their mutual funds group. And at that company, we found that there were a lot of projects for compliance. Compliance was going through a process with some of the scandals in the early 2000s, like the Enron scandal, and the passage of Sarbanes-Oxley, the passage on the financial services industry side of the mutual fund late trading rules. A lot of that led to compliance having to really step up its game. So in financial services, for registered investment advisors and fund companies, we had a rule that came into effect, the CCO rule, that really professionalized compliance and that also assigned personal liability to the chief compliance officer if their firm had any sort of misdeeds. So what that meant functionally for compliance is, you know, in the past, compliance had been a bit of a backwater where compliance may have been a hat that another person was picking up from time to time. Like, for example, in a lot of fund companies, fund accounting would run compliance reports on a monthly basis. It was all really manual. It was really with an accounting mentality. You know, just checking the boxes, going through the concentration on the portfolio and doing it once a month, paper-based, putting it in a drawer, just to evidence to the regulator that you made that check and that your fund was in compliance. With the passage of the CCO rule and with the insertion of personal liability, the CCOs really wanted to take it to the next level. They didn't want to just rely on a once-a-month paper process that portfolio managers would be able to game and manipulate if Right. they knew at what time of the month that check was taking place. And instead, we started rolling out technology like trade order management systems, systems like Charles River Development's CRD system that monitor portfolio compliance in real time and that have components like pre-trade compliance, where before a portfolio manager puts a trade through, the system runs through all the concentration tests, all the exclusion tests to make sure that you're not creating a violation.
And to kind of put this into layman's terms, what is the sure. basis of those concentration tests? Like what is the problem if that concentration gets out of whack? Is it a fund mandate issue? Is it something, you know, kind of, give us a little bit of color on that.
Sure. Like just in terms of, so a lot of it comes out of the Investment Company Act of 1940, that sets things like, say, for example, the number or the amount of illiquid securities that you can hold in a portfolio and caps that at 15% for most funds. Things like portfolio diversification. The end goal of all of those rules is really to protect the investor.
Right.
So it's the regulator, the SEC, after the disaster that led to the Great Depression in the 1930s, put in place protections for investors and also recognized that as mutual funds were growing, as they were gathering huge pools of money, they could have certain practices to manipulate the stock market. So a lot of that is to protect the integrity of the markets, mm-hmm. or to protect the investor, to basically to protect people's life savings against manipulation on the part of fund companies, on the part of financial operators taking advantage or having conflicts of interest.
Yeah, that's a great explanation. That's a great explanation. It's about kind of preserving the integrity of the markets and making it sort of a safe pool for the investor to swim in and know that they're not going to be manipulated, or and also, I guess, preventing, you know, the chain reaction that could come from, you know, the market manipulation and the random yeah. runs on the market, the runs on the bank and things like that. When you're talking a little bit about this CCO rule,
yep.
we know that that was sort of based in a good intention. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about like the good things that came from it, but also maybe a little bit of the unintended consequences you saw. You know, what kind of negative externalities did you see roll out from that rule?
I didn't really see any negative externalities, but what it really created was a rush for firms to get in line with that rule. And the positive externality was really that firms were willing to spend on compliance. So instead of just having a real cost-cutting mentality, firms started to see compliance as a way of preventing risk. So when we're talking about these automated systems, you know, there's license fees, there's implementation costs, it's a heavy lift on IT, it's really a project. And it's also asking the portfolio managers to change the way that they're doing business. You know, before they place a trade, have to run through these checks, have a compliance person be able to sort of second guess the portfolio manager. You know, it's kind of the equivalent of, say, like a constitutional monarchy instead of just a complete autocracy. So the portfolio managers, it's still their job to run the money, to manage the portfolio as they see fit, but to see fit within guidelines,
right,
and to have effective monitoring around those guidelines.
So it kind of put some teeth on this game. It was a very kind of check the box game yeah. before, and now sort of somebody's neck was on the line, kind of similar to how the CFO would have to sign off on the financials, right? Now
exactly.
It's like you got to attest to this thing. You're on the hook if these financials are jacked up. Similar type of principle here. I wonder, like, as you look at other industries, I mean, this is kind of on an industry by industry basis, meaning not every person who's a chief compliance officer is on the hook for the compliance functions and, you know, how closely their operations beneath them are adhering to the rules and regulations that are in place. You know, it sounds like you know, from your perspective, this was a largely positive thing. It drove sort of true compliance by putting somebody on the hook. It drove an incentive effectively for an organization to spend the money to ensure that, hey, I'm a safe boat for you to put your dollars in for this sort of travel across the investment ocean. What do you think yeah. is holding up other industries from making a similar move?
Well, the regulation has a cost. So it only really makes sense if the industry presents risk. I don't think that we'll wind up being in a better place as a society if we just sort of proliferate the number of compliance people out there. You know, and I think one thing that's interesting to say about your company is you're clearly providing a compliance service. But I did notice that in your title, you mentioned ethics. And I think that that's an important distinction between compliance and ethics.
Yeah, let's dive into that some more.
Yeah, I see compliance. You know, the parallels really. Another discipline where there's a lot of parallels is in psychology. So, for example, I know that you're into like the 100-book challenge,
yeah,
or the audiobook challenge. So you're a reader. In one area that I read up in that I could really relate to was in psychology, where there's a whole movement called positive psychology. Big names like Martin Seligman in that space, where Martin's critique of traditional psychology is that it only deals with people who are unwell, and it just gets you to the average. So in some ways, that's where I see compliance as a discipline being. It's really to prevent problems, to prevent and detect problems and to sort of avoid negative deviation and bring firms up to the average, bring firms up to the minimum expectation. But beyond that, I think that once you've established, you know, you're meeting the regulatory threshold, the regulatory requirement, at that point, doing more pure compliance doesn't really get you much. You know, it's really diminishing returns. It's like, sure, you can push down the likelihood of a negative event to, you know, infinitesimally smaller fractions of one all the way close to zero, but you're not really going to get the same sort of positive lift as when you start talking about ethics. When you start having conversations, and the distinction too between compliance and ethics, I think, is that you can have a compliance department with a set of tools, you know, like internal controls, independent testing, monitoring and attestations, et cetera. But that's only going to get you to that sort of zero baseline. Anything above and beyond that, when we start talking about ethics, talking about values, I think that that becomes everybody's job at that point. It's not really just a bastion for the specialists.
I love the way you put that. I love that sort of dichotomy. I mean, it's kind of two sides of the same coin in one sense. And this is maybe a broken analogy, but I'm going to continue to use it until I can think of something better. But, you know, maybe ethics is like this seatbelt. It's like a need to have. It's going to keep you safe. But sort of the elevation of this ethics, or I'm sorry, compliance is sort of a seatbelt. It's going to keep you safe. It's going to prevent, yep, that, you know, stuff. To your point, you get that law of diminishing returns as that graph of extra effort produces, you know, less and less sort of bang for your effort buck. But as you push past that toward, like you said, the values, the culture, you know, the culture effect, this function can really be like a spoiler on the car, so to speak, help drive that culture forward. And again, we're not sort of we're not lowering the risk of something bad happening anymore. I mean, beyond right to that sort of zero point, as you called it. We're really about sort of accelerating beyond that and getting sort of some more good out of this function. Why do you think, I love that picture that you painted. Why do you think so many organizations in really across the economy can't get that light bulb turned on for guys? Or for these functions, why can't they understand that there's a spoiler that they could be putting on the car as well? Why are they so pigeon? You know, why do they have that closed-minded thinking about it just being a seatbelt?
I think it is the nature of just departments. You know, like once something becomes somebody else's job, like if you're able to say like, oh, compliance and ethics, oh, that's the compliance department's job, then you expect the action against that job to come out of their budget, to come out of their department, for them to add headcount, et cetera. So it's just sort of the way that we divide work between departments. And I think that that's where, you know, where some firms have a person whose designated title is compliance and ethics. I mean, I don't see that as necessarily being a synergy. I mean, why couldn't it be the CFO at that point, you know, being representative for finance and ethics, or the product manager, or whoever else has a strategic role? It's the sort of value add ethics and the taking it to the next level, that shouldn't just belong to compliance. I mean, sure, we can advocate for that, but then I think that it's important to sort of share that stage with business partners at that point.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to what you said, where, you know, this ethics piece or this values piece or this sort of acceleration beyond this zero point, the downside against which compliance sort of protects, that is sort of everyone's responsibility. And it's kind of a losing proposition to your point. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm kind of bringing this full circle, or maybe this is just sort of naturally coming full circle, that like, if it's relegated to one person, I mean, this is essentially what you're saying. Maybe I'm just catching up with you. Like, if it's just relegated to one department, then it's just like, okay, well, they got that, when it's actually, it takes all of our buy-in to these ethical behaviors for us to really have a culture that can drive and accelerate and elevate toward sort of a larger purpose or mission.
Absolutely. And you do see a lot of mission-driven companies. So one area that we're involved with as a firm is corporate social responsibility and socially responsible investing. The story changes a little bit, where companies make their entire purpose and ethos to be serving goals in addition to just the bottom line. You know, when you're looking at companies that as a whole take on that ethical message, that values-driven message, you know, the leaders in environmental sustainability, like the Body Shop, you know, they're a cosmetics company. So their product is just cosmetics, but their broader social impact includes the communities that they work in, mm-hmm. includes the environment where they operate in. And that skill set draws on the whole company. You know, that's going to mean that their chemists are going to need to include that in their mindset. Their marketing people are going to include that in their messaging. And when they're planning facilities, et cetera, and locating their operations, they're going to consider how they impact the communities around them. So at that point, it really does permeate the whole ethos of the company.
But the buy-in of it and the execution of it, where do you think, like, you know, where is that most important? Like, if, you know, a lot of companies will say, hey, we're a socially conscious company, right? And, you know, the CEO is going to be on CNBC saying that, or whatever, the website's going to say it.
Right.
In my mind, it's only truly happening if that sort of has trickled down through the whole organization, or it's permeated sort of the ethos of every sort of individual. So like, where does that happen? You know what I'm saying? Like where does that spring up? Does it spring up in the front lines and the bottom? Does it spring up from the top? Does it spring out of the middle? What do you think about that?
I think that culture really has to permeate the whole company. Otherwise, you really wind up with some disconnects, and that's where you might start seeing some calls to the ethics hotlines or other services like that, where you know, the message that people are saying at the top isn't filtering down to the reality that people are experiencing on the ground. So I think in terms of the culture at companies, the challenge in terms of building that tone in the middle also is really there. So I think selecting your leadership, getting people promoted from the inside based on their values, and really living the values in an operationalized sort of way in terms of your actual business practices, really helps align everything.
Yeah, and it's a difficult thing, I guess, as I'm kind of thinking about that question. Everybody plays sort of a different role, right? You know, the people at the top, so to speak, are maybe setting the vision, and they're saying, hey, we need to be this kind of an organization. The people on the bottom, they need to be sort of living that out every day. But it almost gets hard for the folks in the middle, I think, and I'd love you to speak into this if you agree or if you have any perspective on it. But those folks in the middle who often kind of get pinched at some level because there's a lot on the bottom that you have to sort of keep happy and keep guys sort of marching in the right order. There's a lot of sort of metrics and, you know, objective things that you need to, that you're often maybe overly, maybe that's a whole different, you know, discussion, overly sort of compensated for, so to speak. But this other piece, this softer piece, which is really some of the harder stuff, is what is most important to carry that vision, so to speak, from the top down to the front line where it's actually being executed.
There's really a choice at the organization's level in terms of committing to this. And some of the work that I've been lucky to be exposed to is some of McKinsey's work through the Organizational Health Index. We went through a process a couple years ago of using them at the company that I work at to do an employee survey. The McKinsey methodology gives you a rating for the health of your company, and it also gives you really good data and analytics so that you can slice and dice that depending on, say, like the reporting level of people. So you can see, like, hey, are there issues where, say, my middle managers are feeling disconnected, you know, where there are some things that they're seeing on a day-to-day that are sort of disconnects between the message that they hear at the top and that they in turn know that they're supposed to tell their people versus what they do on a day-to-day basis. So through those types of employee surveys, if you really analyze the data and look at it from top to bottom and say, are there levels in our firm where we're experiencing problems where, say, like the engagement is dropping off at a certain level, that'll really help surface those types of conflicts in areas where you're losing traction with that message. What you do about it, then the model gets detailed in terms of some prescriptions, though. Like there's one prescription let me take a step back on the McKinsey methodology. I mean,
yeah,
I think
maybe give like a high overview of this thing,
sure,
of the OHI, and then let's get to what you're talking about, because this is some good meat.
Great. So OHI, it looks at 37 sets of corporate practices, you know, things like, and some of those are, you can't be all things to all people, right? Like you have a specific direction that you're going to be going in. Like, for example, some companies have a great culture built around authoritative leadership, you know, where they've got leaders who are visionaries or whatever, who are setting a firm direction and, you know, not taking any dissension, not taking any guff, and moving the whole ship in that direction, and yet having a really healthy culture, versus other companies choose more of a consultative leadership style, and they perfect the practices around that. So you've got like these 37 different management levers that you can choose to pull, and hopefully to pull them in a way where they coordinate with each other. One set that I really like looking at the McKinsey methodology is pulling out five specific practices. One of them being meaningful values. So really committing to creating meaningful values for your people and having a common set of values that you're building a unified culture around. And then supplementing that with the next practice, which is personal ownership, and really focusing on giving employees work that they find challenging and rewarding, and making sure that those employees feel personally committed to their goals, that they're able to set their own goals and targets when they go through their performance appraisals, et cetera, that they're being measured against something that they committed to personally, and also creating a culture that's open and trusting, so that, you know, once you've told people, hey, we're all committed to these same values, you're given a lot of latitude to set your direction, but we're also, as a company, going to trust you. And that comes through on a day-to-day basis, things like how you look at data and entitlements, how open of a data architecture you're creating within the company for employees to be able to get to the information that they need in order to make a decision on behalf of the company that's really going to benefit it.
So, I mean, it's such a powerful framework. So what advice, I think there might be something here. Like, let's say you're a guy and you see you're in the middle and you see there's problems in our culture, and the guys at the top, the guys at the C-suite, they pay a lot of lip service to this stuff. I mean, like, no CEO you talk to is going to say, yeah, I don't care about values. Like, they'll know, like, they may not actually care, but they're not going to say that they don't care, especially to the organization. But I think any company I've worked in, I think, you know, it's like your kids. Like, they're always looking at you, they're observing everything, and, you know, they're going to do what you do, not what you say. So for somebody who's in that position, who recognizes some of the stuff you're talking about, like, man, if we can get this stuff right, if we can get these 37 levers, or even if we're just talking about five of them, pulled in the right direction and driving sort of the trust forward, and this is really something that can create a culture that's going to empower people to drive toward this mission. But the guys at the top are just not getting it. They're too maybe dollar myopic, or they're too focused on the bottom line, or too short-term focused, or any of these other things that are some of the sort of holdovers from that old sort of industrial revolution mentality that still is largely in place today. what are some good strategies that you think someone could use to like sell this idea internally? Or sell it up. I think, you know what I'm saying?
The first thing is that you really have to sell yourself, right? You have to really commit to it personally and look at really your span of control. And I think a lot of times people undervalue the span of control that they have. You know, they're able to make decisions. Like they are able, when an email lands in their queue, they can either choose to ignore it and let somebody else who's copied on that deal with it, or they can step in and say, yeah, I see that that's a problem and that that's something that we need to do something about. And, you know, whatever support I can lend you as the person who's calling out the problem, let me know. You know, I think that there's a real distinction there. So there's 100 micro decisions that we make. You know, we're working in a really fast-paced modern work world where we get a ton of emails coming in. If you take a moment and look at anything that's in your inbox and say, what if my best self received that email? What would they do? Is there any action that they can take within their span of control that would have a positive influence on this next micro decision? And, you know, if you're making that other person, a colleague, a peer, feel like they're being heard, feel like it was worth their while to say something if they saw an opportunity for improvement or if they had a grievance or something like that, I think that that really reverberates. So that sort of tone at the middle and engagement at the middle really takes place where people are grounded in their span of control and then see that they have a span of influence that reaches way beyond what they directly control.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think, you know, not to get super, you know, touchy-feely here, but like the walls of the prisons that we live in, we control those, right? And like we can knock those walls down, and our, to your point, influence is really can be a lot greater than we think it is. And I think leaning into that is kind of part of it, right? Okay, so let's say this guy's unleashed now. He says, okay, you know what? I can change this. I'm going to bring my best self to this equation, and I'm going to sort of drive this change. On a sort of rubber meets the road or sort of boots on the ground perspective, what sort of things would you do in your, you know, in your sort of in this hypothetical organization where these guys are saying, yep, you know, they got the values website, they got the, you know, they got the webpage of the values, right, and the mission, but like no one's living it out. It's clear that all they care about is dollars. It's clear that they don't care about their people. What are some of the triggers, or what are some of the things that you would pull on, or what are some of the maybe mechanisms or tactics that somebody from the middle could employ for them to be the sort of spring of sort of cultural change in the organization?
Well, I think you touched on it just sort of inadvertently by saying they only care about dollars. If you really do care about the bottom line of the company and you really look at the data, at the research behind it, you see that companies with a good culture, with a healthy culture, outperform. That this is a way to deliver results. It's really the only way to deliver results in the long run. I mean,
in a knowledge work economy, to your point.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then for the individual employee, they have to also invest in their own knowledge. I think that if you look at your span of control, if you look for opportunities to have a positive influence, you're going to be able to do so much more if you know more. If you get to know people outside of your silo, if you just have basic curiosity in terms of how your firm operates, how your industry operates, and how real long-term outperformance is created in your industry and in your firm, you'll often find that that's going to align with a better culture, that's going to align with better practices, and that pulling those levers is going to yield results ultimately.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, right? In this new economy where the assets are in the brains of the people, where the people are truly you know, the greatest assets of the organization, unleashing those folks and is really going to drive the results that everybody wants. But again, it's like this, it's this weird like mental block a lot of folks still have around this being sort of the antithesis of the pragmatism, bottom line thinking, hey, we got to get the dollars, you know, get those dollars to the bottom line. it's just kind of an interesting, it's like this interesting counterintuitive problem that like a lot of companies are facing.
Well, data and metrics really matter. I mean, if you look at how much an engaged employee outperforms a disengaged employee, then you realize that that's really the frontier where that marginal dollar can be earned, is getting that next employee to be more engaged and to be more engaging for everybody that they deal with internally or externally. You know, a lot of companies look at, say, like the net promoter scores in terms of their customer service agents and the people that are talking to the public. But those net promoters, they're talking to people internally who are in turn influencing them. So really the tone, and that's what culture really is. The culture isn't just the stated values. The culture is the sum of all the conversations that happen within the company on a given day. That's really how it lives as a living and impactful entity.
That's a great point. So yeah, the culture is sort of how these, it's the sum total of all these actions. And really, there's a direct tie to a profit center, if you want to get sort of technical about this. There's a direct tie, because those behaviors are really drive the reputation of the company. And the reputation of the company is what the brand of the company is. And that's what marketing is doing. And that's what sales is trying to leverage out in the marketplace. So, I mean, it is, you know, this sort of siloed approach to like, oh, that's a cost center. That's a... you know, that's a profit center, that's a cost center. It's a very bizarre approach. I mean, this is an integrated organism, you know, a company is. And imagine if you had that same mentality for like the organs in your body. Like, are your lungs a profit center? Is your heart a cost center? You know what I'm saying? Like, it all needs to work together for the body to continue to live. I just love the way you put that like really kind of tied it all together. I want to be conscious of time. I feel like we could keep talking for like another hour. This has been like phenomenal. How can people find you, and how can they get in touch with you? You have a great brain and a great sort of heart for this stuff, and it's an interesting and you have a really interesting perspective that a lot of folks, I think, in your industry, maybe not in your types of roles, don't have.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that, Nick, and I think that you're pretty unique as well. I've seen a lot of your videos in terms of your leadership style. I'm really impressed with the brand that you're building, you know, just around authenticity. So I'm actually happy in my current role, but I am on LinkedIn. Folks can find me. I'm Frank Gallia on LinkedIn, and always happy to talk to peers in the industry and others out there. Particularly, I'm interested in talking to companies that are in the regulatory technology space or the RegTech space. So I've been working at this intersection between technology and compliance for some time now. I'm really taking an interest in data analytics now, and in taking some of these insights and presenting them to colleagues in data-driven ways. So happy to talk to any peers out there who are doing similar work, any companies in the regulatory technology space that are trying to bridge that chasm to being able to get their product ready to sell to big financial services companies. If you're looking for just insights on how our departments operate, how our mindset works, you know, how to sell to big Fortune 100 financial services companies when you've got a unique solution that maybe your typical compliance department hasn't considered yet. Those are the folks that I'd love to talk to.
Yeah, well, that's great. We'll obviously put links to your social and everything on there. I feel like you got a book in you, Frank. You got something in you, man.
I need a sabbatical for that. That's for
well,
sure.
Yeah, I was talking to a guy, and you could just dictate it in your car on the way in, and somebody will type it up for you. I don't know. I'm brainstorming.
Oh, there you go.
I think you got a book in you. Anyways, thank you so much, Frank. This has been a phenomenal conversation.
Thank you, Nick.
Appreciate your perspective, and thanks for joining us on the Ethics Experts.
Splendid. Thank you.